Well, Herb, it's a great pleasure to have you with us this afternoon to do a follow-up to an interview, the sort of standard interview that you did earlier this year, you're saying, with Nancy Peroso. Maybe just for identification purposes, I should have you at least give your name, put it on the card, and what your position is, and then we'll take it from there.
My name's Herbert Danaher, and I'm currently United Steelworkers Staff Representative, Regional Representative, and I originated from started in Saskatchewan. We pulled back in 1975, so I've been doing the servicing work since 1986, but I spent a good part of my youth in the industry and in servicing, still service the grain properties today. Mm-hmm. Certainly they've evolved into something much different than when I was first starting. Mm-hmm. cut my teeth in the younger days, but
so looking back then, it's almost 30 years that you've been doing the servicing work from 86 to 2015. You took over from Frank Mazur, you've been assisting him actually earlier.
Yeah, I originally got elected to a position in 1986 with a Transportation Communications Union. We used to actually be in BRAC.
Good old TCU and BRAC, yeah. The Brotherhood of Railway, Airline, etc. Clerks.
Steamship Freighthandler Express Station employees and everything else under the kitchen sink.
Grain Handlers Lodge 650.
Yeah, so Joe DeZergo was actually the assistant to Mazur. We were in a railway structure at the time, so it was an assistant general chairman position, assistant to the general chairperson, and of course we called him chairman at that time, and typical railway structure, system boards. And I was interested and active, and I became an executive officer, and then ran for the full-time position because it came available. And nothing wrong with the incumbent, but just as, there's a lot of younger people on the waterfront, and I was working and going to school at the time, taking industrial relations to college, and had become active with union education and whatnot. So I put my hat in the ring, and lo and behold, more wife supporters came out that day, and Joe's supporters stayed home. So I really inherited the position by, a stroke of, luck or
the voice
or
of the people. As I lost mine 2 years later by the voice of the people, and then for the party members of '93 treated me the very same way. My supporters didn't come out.
No.
And what's his name? David, who ran against me, got his people out.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then. So
just to finish off that part of the story,
by all means.
Frank Mazur then transcended to 1987. There was the national president for our organization stepped down. So Frank Mazur filled that position in the interim and then ran for election and was elected. So he served in a national president's capacity from 86 till 91. So I didn't really get a chance to work directly with Frank is an assistant, but I did work with him, as a recording secretary for a significant period of time. So he was quite familiar, and he sort of took me under his wing. He was a bit of a mentor. But Richard McFarland is actually, took over for Mazur, and moved from the assistant's position and ran for the actual general chairman's position against Richard McFarland. And again, another incumbent that, had been a long activist and was a steward at the site when I first got hired on at the elevators and whatnot. But again, it was sort of a natural progression. The democracy promotes this type of competitive nature. There was four people vying for the position, and a couple of people that were good candidates stepped aside so that I would have an opportunity to get in there, and they recognized some potential, I presume, and they were somewhat friends of mine. Mm-hmm. So we ended up, there was some dissatisfaction, be it, valid or not, of mm-hmm. Richard. This happens in his business. Sometimes as you make tough decisions, you alienate people, and sort of create a horde of people that come out and vote against you because they didn't like, he had the tough decision to make, whatnot. So I ended up taking over for him, and then in 98 we merged with Steel, and in 99 formally sort of closed that deal, and then I became mm-hmm. a staff representative. Prior to that, I was always in an elected position. But the grain industry had sort of already started to evolve, and what was happening was that I started to become sort of servicing multiple industries.
And I like to tell, as a steel rep.
Yeah. Well, I actually even as a TCU rep at the time, mm-hmm. because the grain industry had already started shrinking. So our membership had dropped to about 1,200, probably about 900 people, actively working, down from about approximately 2,000 or mm-hmm. 1,800, I think, was our peak.
And that's what Frank talked about it. Yeah. 1984, what I read.
Exactly. So as this thing was transitioning, we had a starch and gluten plant, Ogilvy starch and gluten plant at the time. We had the CP Rail Express. We had Canpar. We had Interlink another long haul trucking company, and so I got involved with those particular properties and become multi-dimensional. And mm-hmm. of course, because there was so much insight into the grain, like it was a high profile type industry. When things were happening on the waterfront, it always garnered national attention. But the other work, which was just equally as important, sort of went unnoticed, and that's mm-hmm. that was okay by me. We were more involved with servicing the members and doing what we do on a daily basis. We don't do this for the accolades or the press coverage.
No.
A lot of the press coverage was sort of forced upon us, and we reacted when the downsizing started. We had a real negative persona, and especially some of the Western papers, like the Western Producer or whatnot. So when I got involved and got elected, we sort of had a strategic action plan, and we learned very quickly that complaining about what was happening with the restructuring in the industry wasn't doing us any good. It was nobody was going to listen to a woe's me story. So what we did is we started to come at it from a business perspective and utilize some of my background and my education, and took a different approach, and we talked the business lingo, and then we profiled what an actual grain handler makes in the course of a year, and the seasonal layoffs and the type of downsizing, people with 6, 10, 15, got to a point where people with seniority were losing their jobs. So we totally changed the persona, and of course for some they didn't like that because we were a good focus. We were the enemy to many, and if they didn't blame the railway, if the farmers couldn't blame the railways, they would blame the grain handlers for their ill wills. But in actual fact, we were equal partners with the farmers, and what they did was paramount to whether we worked or not.
Of course.
And then with the wheat board, among others, where they were shipping their grain, and of course the dynamic with the Russians becoming self-sufficient, the whole dynamic of the industry, and we were destined to be mm-hmm. a residual port, and we were advised...
against the West Coast.
Yeah. And then as we were advised that... that our numbers were going to drop substantively, to 50%. Well, that was a misnomer because our numbers actually dropped down from 2,000 to 200.
Yes.
So we were a tenth of, we were a shadow of our former self. So it was much more devastating. And then we started to see the consolidation of the waterfront. Yeah. Like you talked about walking the waterfront.
Could I stop for just a moment and go back to you mentioned the media, and particularly the Western Producer. I'd love to know something about the Producer and maybe the Manitoba Cooperator and any other media with whom you interacted. What was going on in their editorial policy, perhaps? What kind of stance they had?
In actual fact, I give them full marks because when we got a hold of them and really challenged them on what the misinformation was, they actually sent a reporter down here and did a full profile, three or four, page, article on what was happening in the grain industry.
This is what the Western Producer?
The Western Producer. Manitoba Cooperator was a little bit more friendly, but same thing. We had, we contacted them and some of the magazines as well. Although their editorial staff was some a little more hostile, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember the one, I can't remember the name of the publication, but I wrote the person a letter and said that, that basically he was, misrepresenting the facts, and that, I welcome an opportunity to do an interview with him if he could send me the questions ahead of time. And, if he continued with his nonsense, we were looking at a libel suit. Mm-hmm. And I talked to our legal department about, what exactly how he was profiled. It was like a harsh editorial. I remember the next editorial was, make my day, was using the old Arnold Schwarzenegger scenario, which, I got this guy from Thunder Bay, contacting us. Well, still, it made its point, is that, we're not going to stand around and get beat up. And
so it wasn't the Country Guide, by any chance.
I can't remember the name of it. I have it.
There aren't many magazines to my mind. But of course, I've been away from Manitoba for 50 years myself. What I find interesting is that when I read the Western Producer years and years ago, the letters to the editor were full of radical stuff. In fact, given my own quite conservative upbringing, I found them just wild letters very often. So clearly, the Western Producer itself changed. Of course, the radicals may have died out, and the next generation of farmer was very different, especially those in the pools who let the leadership take them the way they did, which can take us to.
It's ironic. So I wouldn't, the Western Producer, once we got them the information, of course, they wanted to report the facts as they were. And certainly, that became sort of a benchmark. And instead of being fat cats and whatnot, stray cappy grain handlers. We changed the whole persona. That was important, from a community structure and our members. And then we used the press quite a bit. And we kept going back to the press with our message to make sure that people understood, what the fights were about. And it wasn't about more or greed or anything like that. It was about, structure, looking at what's an appropriate corporate response to the downsizing in the industry. And to be quite frank, there was no appropriate corporate response unless we forced them to the table. And, we had the strike in 91 when I first got involved. That was because we wanted to discuss pensions and, getting some type of, indexation, 2% protection, cap or capped at 2%. And then dealing with the whole thing about early retirement or enhanced early retirement packages so we could transition, people that were ready to, leave the industry and salvage some of the jobs. This wasn't about new hires. This was about people with 10 or 12 years seniority that already had a third of their life, their life's work in the grain industry, being displaced. So
When you were into a reduction to 10 by 90%, which you couldn't know about yet in 1991, probably in your bones you feared what was
going on. We were reacting like at that stage around 1,200, I think is what we had at the time. About 900 were working. And so we were taking, appropriate measures in that particular regard. But it's interesting, the press, like Rick Smith, the dearly departed, he was... it's all sensationalism and the old, I've been, interviewed, I would dare say thousands of times, but hundreds of times for sure. And at the end of an interview, ironically it was, if you didn't say you were going to go on strike, they would say, but if the worst case scenario was, you're going to have some type of a labor dispute.
We should put on the record here a conversation I had once with Rick Smith, probably when I was MP, and after the conversation, he's just becoming, his amiable self, whatever he had been a few moments earlier, he was telling me about his NDP relative. I'm not sure he hadn't run for the party in Nova Scotia and so on and so forth. But Fraser Dugal, another dear departed, wouldn't tolerate that kind of stuff on the air.
No, he was kind of radical. But I remember we had this strike and, and he was still reporting it as something that it wasn't. And of course, the odd time I would, call up and basically try to set the record straight somewhat or send a letter to the editor or whatever. But I remember the next time we negotiated, it was very quiet. We didn't end up using the federal conciliation process, which was very unusual in the grain industry at that stage. We basically, butted heads a bit and we ended up, making an agreement because we didn't want to go to the interest arbitration, the things that we had seen last time. So he had made this big to-do about tri-cappy grain handlers, which is as far from the fact as one can imagine. And then so I sent him a letter and said, "Hey, Rick, guess what? We just settled a contract without any assistance. Amicable settlement to move the industry forward. And you think he would say one word about it? No. And that's just how it was. It was always this sort of sensationalism type aspect.
It's one might as well moralize about this. The farmers who had pooled together in order to enhance their economic well-being had to employ grain handlers in Thunder Bay in order to move their product. And here they found themselves led or thought themselves into a conflict of interest between people who want to make a living here and need to make a living in Thunder Bay and the industry that is attacking that and the farmers.
There is a lot of similarities. And like the National Farmers Union, they used to come to town on a regular basis. We read the records, Frank, and we had some degree of relationship with them. And they were sort of a user-friendly farmer group.
Yes.
There were some people that we knew from the pools, all three pools, that were a little bit more labor-friendly. But the hierarchies, were at war all the time. I remember sitting on the Senior Grain Transportation Committee. And again, talk about ironic, the Conservatives were in power.
During the Mulroney government.
Yes, and the minister was from Crosby, I think it was. So Richard McFarlane, who I dare say was right-leaning in his political views, struck up an accord. We did some lobbying in Ottawa and struck up an accord with this individual and ended up that instead of appointing a CLC representative, which would normally be the case from one of the bigger affiliates, they appointed Richard McFarlane to the Senior Grain Transportation Committee. And then when I displaced Richard in the electoral process, I ended up assuming into that role, that responsibility. So in any case, they used to have all kinds of representatives, farmer representatives, and there was a wide, you could really understand a wide variety. Some people were just day-to-day, mouth-to-mouth, small farm, and some farmers were very big, very efficient, very established, and basically millionaires. And yet, everybody sort of flying the same banner, but One thing I remember, you know, meeting with some of the senior executives and like a vice president, like Leroy Larson, the fellow's name was, if I recollect correctly. But anyway, it was a senior official from South People. I got one of their, I figured he was like a volunteer, like our vice president of the local union. And I checked his salary and it was reported in their circulars and whatnot. And like, he was a $500,000 a year person. Like, so that to me was not indicative of another representing executive. Farmers. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't the grassroots person that, you know, who what the pool was really formulated on. It became big business.
Well, we might say, put on the record as well here, I was reading the Atlantic Monthly and 2 or 3 years ago now, I guess, and there was suddenly this article on the family farm survival. And when I glanced at who had written it, she was the daughter with the Bloomberg Business News organization. Her father was a farmer in the Peace River country of Canada, out in Alberta. Well, it was Chrystia Freeland, who is now a minister in the Trudeau government. The family farm was doing a $3 million business each year. Well, I'm half a century and more away from my father's family farm in Manitoba, but $3 million struck me as not exactly the usual family farm.
No. And I guess, you know, the way that the whole business evolved is that it becomes more mechanized and you have to create efficiencies and size and everything that goes with it. But again, I think the persona of, typical profile of a farmer. I mean, not that, without the farmers, there's no grain industry. So,
no, quite.
Without a doubt. But like I said, it sort of evolved and it's still a tough business to be in. But definitely the whole persona and the business. And that's why I think in part, you've seen the $500,000 a year person's, making determinations for the membership that I don't sure that was in their best interest, because all the pools have basically all but, not all but disappeared off the face of the earth, right?
I was doing research on fiscal history earlier this year and looking at the national accounts of the country, income, wages and salaries, supplementary labor income, corporate profits, the income of unincorporated farm operations. And of course, that series is a horror. Whereas labor income has only fallen once from 1 year to the next, that was in 09 because of the crisis we've gone through. The farm income just went up and down and rises and falls. And I mean, the lesson there for the finance ministers would be, don't trust resource industries as the base for fiscal policy. You want to focus on labor income first of all, corporation profits. But so the farmers have had their ups and downs, and that will continue, I'm sure. Anyway, I interrupted you when you were going to walk the waterfront.
Oh, well,
virtually,
I mean,
speaking,
it's,
of course.
Yeah, it's an interesting analogy. And of course, we represent the shipyards, just recently closed or in bankruptcy. We're just winding up the proceedings
done,
there.
On the ship repair.
So, I mean, actually the mills further down, were cornerstones. But when you walk the waterfront and really take a look for what was there, even, a friend of mine ends up, he bought an East Greenpoint Road. He bought the property at the end of that. It was a fishing outfitters, location there. And he had some old buildings there. And some of the old buildings are still exist on that. But when you really look at, how the industry, on the waterfront, where what it was and where we've been and where we're at, it's quite dramatic. But I mean, nowadays, if you start from the current river end and walk your way through, I remember 17 years old riding my bicycle, down at the Pool 4 applying for work and, started the grain industries at the age of 17. And, it's just the nature is that, the other current river terminal was, was really shut down for all extents and purposes until this recent sort of acquisition switching out with Richardson, through the Competition Bureau, selling off some of the assets or whatnot, because, it had run its course and had been more or less mothballed. So it's sort of resurrected itself to a new life. So that's percolating.
Richardson's have it resurrected.
Yeah. And then, of course, Richardson's has sort of the cornerstones, and then you've got the old Pool 4 A and B. That has quite a history. It's where the explosions occurred in, I think, 45-52. That's where I started, and it was two really separate operating, entities there that would sort of ship out to one side of the building, but it was really two terminals, combined with a single shipping process out the side. So that's there. Like, I mean, there are some people that go into these industries that are shut down. You can find them on the net, and they've gone through and they've taken a bunch of pictures, and you can actually go inside and see what's left of it. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty horrific. And then as you go down, you know, you're looking at where the sawmills were, and you know, these are all sort of kitty cornered to each other.
Northern Great West Timber.
Great West Timber, yeah. And then you got the old Marina pool. There's, yeah, it's Manitoba Pool 2, I think, is the old elevator. There's still some structure left on that site. I remember, you know, there used to be a pool 9 between Eugene and Grain Growers and pool 4. I mean, the activity for the summer, the entertainment was to watch. They had a you know, a big crane in a wrecking ball and basically knocked down the pool 9. It took them a couple of years to do it.
Or was it 6?
No, it was 9.
Okay.
It was actually a terminal that was between the two terminals. There was actually another Alberta pool 9 there.
Further north.
No, it was the UGG current, the current river Richardson terminal.
Currents.
And then there was the Alberta pool one, and it was a narrow, smaller elevator. And then you had pool 4, A and B, and then you had Richardson's.
Oh, okay.
And and then
the
as you.
North end.
Yeah. So then as you proceed down and you have the old pool 2, I wasn't familiar, I'm not exactly sure what year that one closed. Nancy would know that. Then as you go, you know, and look what's happening at the, you know, Manitoba pools, well, you know, we've actually gone in there. We did a tour through the Friends of the Grain Elevators, and they've got, you know, they're salvaging, and they've taken out steel tanks. And they have a vision to open up some condos and do a restaurant in that particular location. Now, whether it ever comes to fruition, you know, who knows, right?
Yeah.
Anything's possible over time, and but these things have been sort of bought and sold. But then you've got
Canada. So this is in the north end of the intercity group.
Yeah, exactly. The first
pool
first
6, we just slid by.
Oh yeah, well, pool 6. I remember.
I mean, that's the one I feel so sad about. I think we should have left it at the midway point to demonstrate how strong those walls were.
Well, when you know, they imploded it at the end, right?
And I guess so.
It was a $2 million venture that the city ended up paying for, because what was happening is that they would be selling these terminals to the scrap dealers. The scrap dealers would salvage whatever they could out of it. And as my understanding of how it went, and then they'd go derelict in their taxes, and then the taxpayers, you know, the community ends up taking back the elevator, and I think it was a $2 million bill that was left. But I remember one of the local, I got to press the button, one of the local politicians, Mr. Scully, I think, who's a businessman in the community. I remember he was in tears, but one thing is, I think he should have been in tears about the $2 million he just spent, you know, imploding the thing, but... And then you're getting saddled with it. But really, I mean, his sort of expression, he never worked there as far as I knew, but I mean, I did, and I watched the thing, and it wasn't, it was a sad event, if I can put it that way.
Yes, of course.
No different than, you know, going down to shipyards for the last times, or the closure of the labor center.
Yeah, another very sad event.
Yeah, I mean, these things, it's an evolution, and times don't stand still, and everybody understands, but when you're part of a living history.
Yes.
And then, you know, you go out and turn the lights out of a building. It plays in, especially when you've been there and you're part of the history and you were participating in, you know, part of the history of people and characters and events that you know, that are long probably forgotten, and you know, a few people like yourself might, you know, drag this up from time to time, or a book writer. But I mean, the new generation, you know, has no clue about, you know, where we've been or what we've done. And you don't experience, and it's no different than I wasn't aware of what my forefathers or foremothers did, and it really goes the same way.
MacArthur Labor Association 100 years ago, and so on. Yeah, there's a rich history. Steel, what, the carpenters, and United Food and Commercial were the last union.
Yeah, and CUPE. And CUPE was there.
Oh, CUPE,
well.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Right. So were you all leaving at the same time?
Basically, within a month of one another, right? Because we have sort of a sunset date there, and so we've dispersed. The memberships are smaller. The memberships are more dynamic. Memberships are more technologically savvy. Mm-hmm. There's different ways to communicate. You don't necessarily have to have the type of presence. I'm not sure. It really lost its
the labor center.
Yeah, I think the people that have a view about the labor center that you know, we lost our identity. You know, I don't think it was really that way, because so many of the other industries had dispersed, like all the trades and Unifor, like the CAW, CEP, they had long left the building, right?
Well, that's the one judgment I would make, that it was the spreading out of the unions in the city rather than clustering there that actually doomed the labor
center. I think what happens is that the building, the facility itself, I don't think people really understand this, maybe we're digressing a bit, but the facility itself... you know, was built, you know, in with a different purpose in mind. And although there was, you know, bringing the labor bodies together, but it was too small for,
it became, you know, too small for sure.
Yeah. So, and then people needed more space and it was fully booked. And over time, you know, the limitations of the size of the structure itself became detrimental, right?
And if an office section had been built on the south end of the building, so an H shape had been developed, perhaps, letter H, with enough space for all of them. But certainly CAP's moving over to that, what was that, a hall once upon a time, where they still are, where Unifor now is, was a certainly, maybe, well, I don't want to hang it on them in terms of the death knell of the labor center.
There was a dynamic, but a lot of it was due to, you know, the modernization and just infrastructure, so it's much different than what people might think, and it's not necessarily negative. It's actually positive because people need to go. Like, we have a building, we have a training. Like, we bought a building. One of the locals bought a building. The district is renting an office there. We have a training room for a training facility there. So we're doing different things.
Where are you now, Jim?
We're on May Street, 331 North May Street.
North May.
So it's an old Cal Palace, Funeral Northwest building. So we're just doing some.
Oh, it's the Northwest Alternatives is the building you've taken over.
We inherited it.
Whereas they've moved to, was it the OSSTF that was in the building they're now in? Oh, the changes in real estate.
But they, anyway, it's going down the waterfront, and, you know, you got the Canada Malt, and then you got 7A and B, which is Viterra. And, you know, Viterra is really, you know, Glencore. And Glencore is a huge, you know, multinational company.
Like
in
Switzerland.
We've got
Rupert. What was his name who created Glencore?
We've got representation, you know, through that company with a number of our mining sites and whatnot.
What, Viterra owns mine?
Not Viterra.
Or Glencore.
I mean, Glencore continues to carry on business with Viterra, so they say. We're in a bit of a legal fight about this, but, you know, they are not, you know, they basically have care and control. And the bottom line is they're dictating. They kept the same people in place because it made sense to do so. But for all extents and purposes, you know, Glencore. And right now they're in a little bit of, you know, the way the grain industry is right now, they're a little bit of a peak. And it's not going to stay that way forever. You know, it's over time, you know, the reality will set in, you know, for the remaining of the competitors in the waterfront. But
why don't you talk about Viterra a bit, because that's the end result of a number of mergers, which took up companies, organizations that we were referring to earlier.
Well, I remember sitting, I came back from my holidays early. It was July 31st or July 30th, one of the two dates, and I remember waiting for a call, and we had it from good sources that Cargill was purchasing Manitoba Pool. I got the call, and it was a representative from Manitoba Pool, and we were advised that UGG had purchased, you know, so whatever, you know, you have a good source, a reliable source, well, you know, it's not worth a hill of beans until the actual, you know, deal is pinned.
So UGG bought Manitoba Pool.
Yeah.
Because the United Grain Growers is, of course, turn of the, more than 100 years ago, they're the first farmers organization. So they're the ones then who got Manitoba Pool. Yeah.
And they, and you know, in actual fact, Manitoba Pool was aggressively pursuing UGG at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they made a pile of money because, you know, when the whole thing was over, because they guaranteed them, you know, some kind of, I guess, when you do these business deals, if the deal falls through and you're a serious buyer, they pay some kind of a penalty. So I know that they made millions of dollars off the potential sale. But ironically,
and UGG did.
Yeah. Well, no, Manitoba Pool did before they sold to UGG.
Okay.
And then when UGG, you know, resurrected itself, not resurrected itself, but, you know, asserted itself, and it ended up being, you know, reverse sort of scenario. And
did they get the money that they paid to Manitoba Pool, or had it been dispersed, I wonder?
Well, I mean, it was all part and parcel. I mean, Manitoba Pool was an old school type company, and at least from my experience in the waterfront, and they were, we didn't have much dealing with Alberta Wheat Pool, of course, but between, you know, Saskatchewan Wheat Pool and Manitoba Pool, there was a, you know, a huge difference in philosophies, I think, and one was more old co-op, and one was a modern, evolving, a progressive, aggressive type scenario. So we always got along much better with the Manitoba Pool. They had core values that were closer to our own. I think they're all business when it gets down to the end of it, but I think they were more legitimately, I think they legitimately cared about people and farmers and communities and these types of things.
I mean, co-ops and credit unions have to be businesses, obviously. But the spirit in which the business is carried on can vary quite a bit.
And they had a different, you know, the people in charge had a different perspective and different core values than maybe some others.
So, well, I happen to ask Poole.
Well, I mean,
I appreciate as a better of a farmer's son. I appreciate better of Poole, but Sask Poole.
So UGG ended up, buying the Manitoba Poole, and then Alberto we pulled out stage. You know, had already sort of assimilated, and they ended up this AgriCorp type scenario, right? Hmm. So Manitoba Poole and Alberta Poole scenario had sort of evolved. UGG bought what was left of the pools, and then it ended up by Terra, who was really in financial duress, the weaker of the sisters, because UGG had created UGG had created the biggest grain company in Canada now because of the acquisition.
And those other two pools spanning.
Yeah. And so then it ended up that, so then you had the tail wagging the dog. You had the weakest of the sisters. Mm-hmm. Buying the mighty UGG. It just didn't make any sense. It was counterintuitive, but that's exactly what happened. And then
they took over Agri.
Yeah, and then they had to divest some of the assets to Cargill, some of the country assets. They had to divest some of the country asset, the port facilities because of the competition bureaus and whatnot. These rulings. So there was all sorts of divestiture that was happening. With that particular restructuring. And then you ended up with a situation where Glencore came in and basically, did a $6 billion deal and basically, bought out the Canadian, a good section and a good portion of the Canadian grain industry.
Yeah. Well, Sask Poole had gone public, stock, had they not, on the Toronto Stock Exchange. When did that take place? Was it already in the mid-90s?
Maybe even a little earlier.
It had been a cooperative. It had been a kind of a mutual company of the farmers. To go to the market, you weren't at the Sask Poole conventions where that was approved, but the farmers...
It was a political hot potato. And, there was, at the end of the day, the majority rule is what it boiled down to. And then it's a matter of how you get fair value. So everybody, of course, got shares. And the members, we could buy shares. I mean, I think the shares were starting listed at $10. I think they went up to $24, $27. And I think in the end, it got down as low as 18 cents. Mm-hmm. So you had this mighty pool had, something had gone terribly wrong, right? For that type of disaster. And they became international players. And they had really expanded beyond, what was comfortable. So they had deals in Poland and Australia and these types of things that went awry, I think.
Deals, not selling grain now, but operating facilities.
Purchasing terminals or, partnerships and a lot of this stuff went awry. And I think they got themselves into, they were way bigger than the vision that they needed to be.
So the guys in the Regina headquarters were the ones who were making these deals, first of all.
Yeah.
Got themselves in debt over their ears, I suppose.
And it became a leverage company. And the thing with when Sask Poole was doing about $1.5 million, $1.7 million, Granger was doing $1.7 million. And then so you figure you merge two companies, two competitors in the waterfront that are doing about $3.5 million a year. That's about half the handle for the year. That grain evaporated. And, you had Sask Poole, doing 1.4 at the end of the merged entity. And there became more diversification and more specialized grain.
Are we talking dollars or tons?
Tons.
Tons of grain.
So, and became more diversified. There was more GMO-type products. There mm-hmm. was more specific type of specialty grains we'd ever seen. So it actually necessitated that they run the UGG plant. Otherwise, those plants never would have operated again. Certainly Manitoba Pool 3 never operated. And to any great degree, and then the grain growers plant basically end up being mothballed because the 7A and 7B, it could handle it. It's got a huge huge volume of
down there in the intercity.
Yeah, but they but overall, like I said, these specialty grains and they had some barley products. So this sort of artificially. Created a business presence that sort of maintained the facilities, but in actual fact, the actual handle had dropped.
So but they were put Western grain in that same list, isn't it? Because Western if it weren't for specialty grains, they probably wouldn't operate either.
No, and of course because they were going to be able to handle the wheat board grains and whatnot.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the wild card, you know, in the last 10 years was the Mission Terminal, who's, you know, now is owned by, you know, the wheat board, which is a story all in itself. You know, why would the
government... You want to tell it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know all the gory details. What I do know is that, you know, if you're going to put the stake through the heart, then why would you allow some type of a five-year transition? And why would you allow, you know, a government entity for all intents and purposes to become an active participant and competitor in the marketplace that's already overcapacitized? It's just a word, if that's a proper word or not. But I mean, there's
well, it conveys the sense. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just ridiculous, right? And now they've bought ships, you know, they own infrastructure, and they're not a valid grain company. They're what's left of a government entity that the government has allowed to resurrect itself and skew the marketplace.
Let me just toss out a bystander's thoughts about all of this. With Viterra combining so much of what the farmers had built almost 100 years ago, some of it even earlier actually, and under the control of this speculative firm out of Switzerland, Glencore, what was left for farmers who were unhappy about that was conceivably the turning of the wheat board into the pool today, although they'd have to do it voluntarily. They no longer had the government control. And so I had some hopes with interest that a left winger and all of this, I suppose, that the wheat board might become that new operating entity that farmers could contract with and so on. And then to have the Harper government shortly before they were defeated at the polls, selling it off, or beginning to sell it off, I guess it's still just part of it. What's your reaction?
Well, the thing is, I think the persona for the wheat, but it does create jobs within the community, right? So there's nothing, you know, there's a lot of ex-grain handlers go and work at that plant. It's a busy plant.
Yes.
I think that the marketplace through the wheat board, you know, they were getting what I would call an unfair advantage and getting sort of first dibs on wheat board grain because, of course, the pools and the bigger grain companies tried to put the wheat board out of business.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of payback going on, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And when you look at how this sort of thing transition to the privatization, you know, the wheat board, you know, senior officer ended up becoming a senior officer in the new competition.
3G entity.
Yeah. But the thing with the farmers and I think people still, like, you're sort of reminiscing about what happened 100 years ago. If you look at the prairies nowadays, and I don't profess to be an expert on prairie grain handling, but I mean, it's huge terminals, like in some cases bigger than like the P&H that we had in Thunder Bay. Like there's these big, you know, centralized, you know, draw points where you're doing 100 car, you know, lots and whatnot. Like the face of the industry isn't this, you know, tens of thousands or whatever there was the number, forget the numbers.
Well, I might tell a little story in this context. I'm a farmer's son, of course, from Manitoba, although I have to say that my father always sold to Patterson's rather than to the co-op, the Manitoba pool for probably ideological reasons, after all, refugees from Bolshevism in 1926, coming out of the Soviet Union. I think there was definitely that kind of attitude. But I remember driving Trans-Canada past Sintaluta, which was where one of the pioneers of the farmers' movement, E.A. Partridge, farmed at Sintaluta, and seeing one of the elevators owned by Cargill. I was chatting with the chair of the history department at the University of Saskatchewan, where I would teach in 77-8, saying, you know, it was the first time in my life I had ever been tempted to arson. It just seemed an abomination to have Cargill owning an elevator in Sintaluta. Well, Cargill eventually built one of these big throughput elevators in Elm Creek, where I went to high school. The thing sits there. And I think it may have been the first of these major elevators on the prairies. And last time I was through Sintaluta, I don't know that there are any elevators left, certainly Cargill pulled out because they had this big facility. And of course, these days you see these big trailers, the highway tractors moving grain and so on. Anyway, back to what you were saying.
It's a different wheel. They're not bringing the grain here with wagons anymore. Let's put it that way.
Oh, you bet.
And they had, and so really, you know, in the railways, of course, you know, it was costly to have branch lines and whatnot. And this was a big thing about the Senior Grain Transportation Act. And I remember The Western Green Transportation Act. So, like, there was a lot of, you know, evolution happening during that whole particular process, and the railways really wanted to divest themselves. They just wanted to catch the grain on the main line, and that's the most efficient way, or go to an elevator that would have a lot of producer cars was a big issue at the time, where, you know, you put it at a siding, and then the farmers could go and load their own cars, and
throw back to the very beginning.
Yeah. So, you know, history sometimes has a, you know, way of repeating itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, to continue the tour, then you had UGGM, which, of course, was sold to, I think, the Harbor Commission right now. But that was, Viterra, you know, owned that property because UGG had still owned it.
Yes.
Then you had the other Manitoba Pool property, of course, again, owned by... UGG, and so technically was Viterra's property, and then you had the P&H plant, who's now shut down, those companies are created a single entity, and they work out of the Cargill facility, which is now Superior Green, and then you got the Mission Terminal, which goes by a different name now because of the wheat board purchase, and of course that was a grain elevator that was derelict, they had been making wood pellets out there, and it was an explosion, it got shut down, and Sasspool didn't have enforceable caveats. It was a never-ending story. Every 6 months you get a call to say that place is going to be shut down, they're not going to be handling grain any too much longer. Well, it never occurred. It was a never-never proposition. And it created a huge, they were doing, it went from, 200,000 or 300,000 ton specialty house, similar to Pole 10, and all of a sudden it became, the biggest handler of, one of the biggest handlers of grain in the waterfront, taking about a sixth or more of the business in the course of a year, right? And they get first dibs in the grain, so the other ones would sit dormant, and they would have cars stacked right out the end of it.
This was the Mission.
Yeah, the Mission Terminal. And you see, they did all sorts of things, like these central agencies that would, the grain transportation group in town that would sort of coordinate the car distribution and whatnot. It just became a free-for-all.
Yeah.
And it's still that way. It's very competitive now on the waterfront. And like I said, you have sort of the five operating facilities. Pool 10 just seems to be a survivor, specialty and whatnot. They run a pretty efficient operation out there. It's kind of a unique plant. And then you've got the two Richardson's facilities. And in certain respects, that business is operating as a single entity, and they maximize utilization of the two plants. When there's logistics, there's a lot of certain times of the year, it's more busier than others, so you need more capacity. There's specialty crops, there's something you have to hold on to because the boat hasn't arrived. So they capacity and whatnot. And 7A and 7B at the Viterra, Glencore facility, that sort of operates in the same vein. So there's a lot. There's a lot of traffic and there's a lot of grain. The throughput remains high.
Mm-hmm.
They could probably still do 10 million a year in the waterfront if the boats, if the stars all align in that particular regard. Yeah. But so it's just a matter of making sure that the boats are here at the time that the grain that's been ordered is there. And of course, the whole thing about, grain and grain cleaning and specialty crops and the whole deregulation, it's a lot different sort of beast than what you've seen in the past. So, and I mean, when grain came in, when it used to come in dirty, I forget what the percentage of but it's a high percentage that comes in, pre-cleaned now. So,
The screenings are on the prairies rather than here.
I remember seeing some documentation in one of the rounds of bargaining we were at, and the audit earnings for a grain handling facility in Thunder Bay was about a third of the revenue. It did make a whole lot of money by taking, the grains and cleaning and blending the tolerances back in. Of course, the tolerances became tighter. The grain comes in clean. You don't get those byproducts. So it cut a lot of the revenue stream out of it. Mm-hmm. We really, in one sense, we always used to do what we called visiting. So I would invite, before bargaining, we had a pretty sophisticated process, I like to think. Wasn't that sophisticated. It was about, getting information.
You were getting information.
And empowering yourselves to make informed choices. And that's what we do with bargain collective agreements. Our job is to empower the membership to make an informed choice.
And the company has every reason to have you be...
Well, yeah, we would invite the company representatives. We'd invite the wheat board, the Harbor Commission, whoever we could get to come to the sessions, and they would give us an overview of what's happening in the industry. And then
it's like the process of discovery in courts, where the lawyers on both sides have a chance to scan the evidence and shorten the trial by focusing on the real issues.
And we would try to get a flavor for what we were up against as well, and then try to build relationships and build bridges as well. So it ended up that we would do it in a vision, right? And we'd have a 1, 3, and 5 year vision. And it would be the same thing. There'll be a lot less grain companies at some point in time. But we what would happen is that we'd end up in a, it would start to really tighten. We'd see significant people laid off for significant periods of time. And next thing you know, we'd have a good year. We did 9 million. And then we'd be good for about 6 years after that. And it happened again. We'd always sort of get a reprieve somehow. And from our perspective, the more companies operating meant more employees, more employment. Sure. And once they started to simulate,
the richer the competition, the better.
The numbers, you know, dwindled, right? So every time there was a merger, when they shut down Manitoba Pool, we lost 100 members. When they shut down Grain Growers, we lost 100 members.
Was the seniority peculiar to each company, or could guys?
No, it was particular to each company. Yeah, so at certain times, you know, over history, when things, you know, started to shrink in one company, somebody had worked there 3 or 4 years, you know, the other company ended up being hiring.
Yeah.
So some people would go over, but you know, sometimes it would end up that you have to pick your poison in a sense. You had this type of established, would the industry kick back here or should you go over there? Sometimes people have made choices to go to a smaller facility, had less turnover, stay, if you got on a steady day shift there, you pretty much had employment for life. On the other side, you needed to have 2 terminals operating and on a two-shift basis, so there was a lot
of... It's been a tough life for the guys over the years.
And some people, they're still grain handlers. I see them walking the streets. I see one fellow, you know, at Shelter House on a daily basis. He was a functional person in our society, and he basically, lives on some type of a disability wage, I'm sure, and frequents the Simpson Street Shelter House area. And
the single saddest call I think I ever made, the 88 campaign canvassing, was a fellow, Italian fellow, who'd lost his job at the elevators, and I didn't know a word I could, you know, say to him. He was just the saddest looking guy.
I experienced it myself, right? And the thing is, when I started in 75, like, I grew up in a generation, and something you never lose, right? Your sort of people that you work with, that people have the fortune to work with, the same sort of grouping and age demographic. And then, within about, by 15 years after the fact, that whole, we got wiped off the face of the map. And these people dispersed wherever, right? So you lose that commonality, you lose that compatriotism. These are your long-term friends. Like, you cannot, as you go through life, you know, you have life experiences and whatnot. Well, you lose that. You can never recapture that. You can't go to another job at age 30, you know, 32 or 30 and have the same experience you did by being a 17-year-old. It's just not the same. So you never... But that's life, right? It's life's experiences. So you get to, one door closes, another door opens type thing. But it was still a sad series of events. And the thing with the grain is that it was always a slow kill. It always looked like it was going to get a little rosier. You always hope for the best.
Next year, country.
Yeah.
In another way.
In some cases, it just, you know, you just dragged on and on. Or you got back for a brief reprieve. Instead of cutting yourself loose, and some people that did cut themselves loose, they become nurses and worked in different industries. They've done quite well and experienced things, and nothing wrong with work in industrial establishments. But you know, people really probably have a lot of potential that they never get to exude because they never have the opportunity. Where in some cases, some of these people did, and some people have just been stuck in lower paying occupations, and that's fine too, but you need to carve out a niche and you become a survivor. And
how did UIEI operate for the guys?
Well, EI was always like really, it became
post 95.
Yeah, it became a crutch, right? Is so then you could continue, try to get your weeks in for EI.
And similarly for UI earlier? Distinguishing between the two? Yeah, or is there any?
There is no distinguishing.
As far as your people were concerned.
Yeah, that whole EI system, of course, you know, over time was eroded in how to qualify on it. But for a typical grain handler, if you got seasonal work, you'd likely qualify for EI. There's only one time that I remember that I didn't. And I hung my hat on, I had some other weeks I was working elsewhere. But in any case, long story short, is I got back for a week in the fall and that was it. And then I didn't have enough weeks to qualify. So it was extremely important, to get on the EI so you could sort of, survive to the... survive for another season.
And, a little bit like the West Coast or East Coast fishermen, I guess.
Well, the East Coast fishermen probably,
they had real support programs in addition.
We were appealing for some reprieve one time and for EI. And I remember getting, when Ian Angus was a member, MP at the time, and, he hooked me up with an office in... And yeah, I remember going to, I was in Ottawa, and I went across to the Quebec side, and that's where the office was. I met with a high-ranking official over there. And basically what they told me was, you know, that your greyhounders, there was X amount of people, 500 at the time or something like that. I forgot, don't know what the actual numbers were. But they did basically says, their answer to me was, you're not the East Coast fisherman.
You're not large enough. No, yeah.
And you don't have the political clout that they have. So we can't make these particular types of changes, which was some extension to the benefit period to try to get through the period, right? I remember, we had a big fight one time, and so what they would do is that you sort of hang around, and then you'd think you're going to get called back, and you didn't, and a year would pass. We had 3 years of recall rights, which, you know, that would get you through two bad seasons, but it didn't get you through a restructuring of the industry. And and that fail-safe was there more if you had a drought or something. You know,
sure.
You wouldn't lose your recall rights. And then they had a skilled labor pool to pull from. But it ended up at the end of the three-year period, some people, you could access a small portion of your severance pay, in the interim. So if you went off your POGI, you'd be able to draw on some severance pay and still retain your recall rights. And then POGI, or EI, they basically went back and they wanted to then deduct, you know, the third year you finally got the rest of your severance pay.
Take the severance pay back.
And they wanted to claw
the EI.
So we had, in those days, of course, they don't have this anymore because it's Service Canada and it's a different beast, but you used to have, you know, specialists, and you could go and talk to somebody and talk sense to them. And so what they did was, the expectation was, you know, that there was still going to be bona fide work, and it only crystallized, you know, the last part of it. So then we didn't have any EI benefits, so they'd let us keep our severance. It was a sensible decision at the time, somewhat prejudicial to somebody in that particular environment. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you know, because I know from, we had the closures at Terrace Bay and Marathon and the shipyards and the whole thing about how the EI system works now, it's bastardized. It's terrible. I mean,
when did that happen? Could you date the change?
Oh, I'm not sure. Like, it's exactly evolved through the 10 years of
the Harper government.
Where you know, there was just no the rules just seemed to be forever changing, and
the local capacity was disappearing, I guess, as you say. Yeah. Specialists were gone,
and then you know, it's a story all in and of itself. I just relate one thing that perturbs me to no end, right? You get these bankruptcy type proceedings, and, you know, putting workers first or whatever. So lo and behold, I've never been in a bankruptcy proceeding yet that somebody actually got money. You know, there's money left that a worker could actually make a claim. Well, the shipyards, you know, is a situation where we're going to get 80 cents in a dollar. So lo and behold, they get this payment, and the government has a surcharge. So that the government charges you through the Bankruptcy Act like 3.5% on the first $1.5 million. I don't quote the numbers, but it's something like that. And then anything above that, it's like 3%. So they actually, when our people get their check back, so they have a WEPA, which is a Wage Earner Protection Program. They deduct that off the claim. You got to pay back all your EI, and you can extend your claim. So some of it you get it back, depending on what your work situation is. And then to just basically kick you one more time, now the government has a surcharge. They take 3.5% of your money.
Initial gross? Or what's
gross, the gross, and they basically take that away from the workers. So when you get a settlement check, the government's taking 3.5% for nothing. And it's just outrageous, right? And these types of complexities or whatever, you know, it just doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, you see a lot of downsizing, like I've seen in my career, if you want to put it that way, or my involvement in the labor movement. There has been some absolute travesties of justice, and I mean, this just puts the icing on the cake. Mm-hmm. Not only do you kick them in the down, and usually they get nothing out of this, and you know, the governance is such that the, you know, the same companies can be operating everywhere else in the country, utilizing the trees like a Marathon. At another site, you know, a few hundred miles away, and not a penny, and they leave an environmental mess. And then, and to top it off, when you get into a situation where there is some kind of funds, and the workers at least get some semblance of justice, well, they've lost their jobs, you have all these clawbacks. But I mean, the 3.5% or whatever it is penalty that the government charges under the Bankruptcy Act, you know, taking workers' money, just doesn't make any sense.
May I ask if you're contemplating approaching the new government to change that retroactively?
I mean, we've made known about the outrageous of it, so we've sort of already sort of, you know, talked. I've talked about
opened
it internally,
sense.
But I mean, whether that would actually change or not, I don't know. But it's definitely something to pursue, because Now, this government is much different than the other one. But, you know, these are the types of things.
These are the kinds of tests of the new government.
Yeah.
Like, do you have any sense of a change on the wheat board, the privatization of the wheat board from this new government? Any hint at all in the...
I've not heard any. I mean, it's a done deal, right? They're done. They operate. The wheat board is basically, you know, an operating entity, competitor in the waterfront.
But if it... Could it remain domestically owned? Could the farmers remain the owners of it? Because they voted against the changes on the wheat.
Well, some of the farmers did, right? So I mean, I guess
the majority.
Yeah, the governance, the structure of it. I mean, anything's possible. But I mean, this is not a co-op. This is a. I'm just gonna shut this off. It's not a co-op. It's a big business agency, and that's that. And so you know, don't fool yourself. This thing about aligning farmers with some type of a type of concept that this is somehow you'd grasp onto this new entity as some type of semblance of it's just a marketing question. It's one-on-one marketing, right? It's about whether you want to sell into the market here or whether you want to, you know, conclude your assets and basically sell them in a different way. Nobody's even doing that anymore in the waterfront.
Well, the wheat board was, of course, a marketing entity also contracting with farmers, or actually had legislated monopoly of certain grains and was able, as a result, to obtain the best return for the farmers possible in the global market. Could the wheat board do that now with farmers contracting with them rather than selling to Cargill or?
But it's a competitive business environment now.
It always was though on a global.
No, it
basis.
Wasn't because the on well, a global for, basis, yeah. but it was it wasn't competitive because the wheat board had a monopoly.
Yeah. Well, in Canada they certainly did, but they faced the
no. But as far as the farmers as far as farmers selling into the marketplace, right? The monopolies with the wheat board, so you had no choice. That's where the grain.
That's right, but. The question, I suppose, that will gradually be answered by the farmers or experienced by them is whether under the wheat board they did better when that was the Canadian monopoly in the global market or whether in the more fragmented situation now without any power, no Canadian company has anything like that kind of power any longer, whether they'll do as well. And I actually belong to the National Farmers Union and received their newsletter, pure sentiment on my part, or almost just sentiment. Latest newsletter had some numbers in it that made me suspect farmers might begin to see that the present situation is not to their advantage.
It'd be an interesting question to see how it does evolve. But I mean, the thing is that, you know, the way the industries have with canola crushing plants, like the whole, like it's not a snapshot in time. Like this thing has evolved, right? So, you know, the whole industry itself and the farmer that's closer to, you know, the delivery point is not pooled anymore. He's going to have a geographical advantage potentially, right? So there's all sorts of things that are happening out there. See, it's not a fair comparison anymore because it's probably a win-loss type proposition. And how what would you grade? Would you grade on the old structure, you know, you have this and then you're going to grade this as a return to the farmers and then somehow you're going to have a comparator. But the comparator doesn't exist anymore. It's a totally different dynamic out in the prairies, right? The business structure, you know, they diversified, they had more livestock, whatever the case might be, whatever they did to address the competitive environment, you can never get a true comparator anymore about what the outcome was.
Well, even in the kinds of grain, you have any thoughts about the Canadian Grain Commission and its disappearance?
Well, I mean, it's this whole thing about the whole structure and the Canadian grain industry for what it was and the governance of it, that basically this is what happens when you deregulate. And I guess people are willing to go into the marketplace and you know, stamp it in a different color. And at one time, we prided ourselves in being able to, you know,
the
stamp on our product. Quality. Yeah. Now we just had a case, I'm not going to say which company, but, you know, in a case where, you know, somebody substituted something and it had some GMO context to it and the whole boatload got turned down and like, there's lots of these things happening.
That was actually in the news, was it?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was in public domain.
This
might be an internal
either,
thing.
But
you know, so these things sort of evolve, so I'm not sure. You know, they're still, it's all done, they still have those services are still being maintained in the waterfront by a privatized company.
What's the company doing it here?
Well, SGS, there's two companies that operate out of here.
And there are two companies actually doing it.
Yeah. So, and they basically, and some of it's done in-house, like some of the companies, you know, geared up and some of them didn't. So,
our very last interview tomorrow is going to be with our son who's happily back in Thunder Bay, but he was in Manitoba in 06, and he ended up working for SGS Canada at the time when they were beginning to try sampling on the farms. So that's going to be an interesting complement to the new era we're now in.
Well, they're advertising on Facebook. They're looking for inspectors right now. So,
are they?
Yeah.
What's and the other company? Did you name it? Right?
I can't remember the name of it. Actually, it's slipped my mind for the moment.
Grain grading Thunder Bay might bring it up. Eh?
Yeah, there's two of them there. So,
well, it's been quite a ride, and continues that. Any thoughts about? Incidentally, what about Patterson's? They were knocking their elevator down on the CAM in 78 when. With the family moved, my family moved to Thunder Bay, and it was a bit heart-wrenching because my father had always sold a Patterson elevator in Kelross.
They still have a presence on the prairies.
Yes, they still have
And Richardson's handles a lot of Patterson's grain. I think there's a business relationship there. Mm-hmm. So,
so Patterson Global Foods has related itself to Richardson's here.
I'm not sure about the name of the entity itself. But I know that we handle a lot of their products. Well, interesting, we sat in the Senior Grain Transportation Committee, which, you know, is going back some time now again, but the two advocates for the East, there was one Seaway person, and then there was one of the Pattersons, not the local, it was a Patterson from that lived out west, and then myself.
From
so they would always, it was Thunder Bay wouldn't even enter into the dialogue. For the most part, unless one of the three of us, you know, said, you know, what about us kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Or we would, you know, from time to time, chastise them to no degree. And they would get their chance to chastise the labor side of it from time to time,
because they were
too,
focused on the West Coast.
Yeah, exactly.
What about Churchill?
Well, interesting. Churchill is just an article, you know, again in the news recently where they're going to divest it to... The First Nations are looking at
buying the rail line and the port.
So ironically, I mean, I think about how much I think they pump $50 million, into that port before they sold it to the company that's selling it now. I'm not sure whether, you know, the global warming, whether you're going to be shipping grain out of, you know, the word was, you know, as things warmed up, you'd be able to ship out of Churchill. But I think the permafrost, they have more and more issues with the infrastructure getting up.
The rail line up will be the challenge.
It's a political question, right? Mm-hmm. It's always been a political question. Yeah. It will always be a political question.
Out of the Carrot River Valley in the 1920s. Yeah.
So if the, the First Nations end up acquiring it, well... First Nations have a lot of leverage, and rightfully so. So it certainly turned a different dynamic. But this is a big company that, you know, got it, you know, and got it for nothing, got it all fixed up. Who wouldn't want to buy a car that just had a full retro on it, right? And then be guaranteed so much product, in the course of a year. And in the long run, I mean, if they can't sustain the model and they got it for nothing, then... How is it that somebody else is going to take over the infrastructure and be able to operate it in a reasonable and feasible way? So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. From my perspective, it never did handle enough grain to put a huge dent. But I mean, as our capacity and throughput went through, if they're handling 500,000 tons, we're handling six, that's a pretty big percentage. That grain would likely go through Thunder Bay. So from my perspective is that, not that I wish any ill will, there's jobs and community and structure, and I've seen enough hurt, from industries that closed down different facilities. Hopefully it'd be busy enough so everybody could prosper. But in actual fact, it's like the wheat board being transcended into another competitor, and it's a competitor that ought not to exist. Mm-hmm. And certainly, Thunder Bay has taken its lumps, right? We've had our closures, we've lost our jobs.
Yeah.
Thousands of jobs. That's not an exaggeration when you get right down to it with the inspectors. Yeah,
over thousands of different people.
Secondary industries and whatnot. I mean, you talk to the groups that used to go in and do maintenance on the facilities, or paint the facilities, or do fumigation of the facilities. Like all these things are part and parcel. So we've taken our lumps, and yet you have these artificial sort of groups that are sort of existing, and they ought not to exist. So if you're going to have any type of semblance of some pure market driven system. Then let's compete on an equal playing field, and really that's what we have now. We have a deregulated industry; it's every person for themselves, and everybody's chasing the same market.
And this is what where the grain industry began, 130 years ago, give or take.
The other dynamic that you might I don't care how it's going to play out, but if you look at the weather patterns and whatnot as well. Who knows? Nobody can predict. I'm a firm believer, though some aren't. About global warming or whatnot.
Science, global warming.
Yeah,
I think you've got believers on the table here. Carry on.
So my view is that look at what's happening. Where you have areas that were traditionally dry that now are wet. Now you got the type of moisture you get in certain areas, and it's just a dog's breakfast out there. And yes. I have no idea what the industry really looks at as far as what can be grown where and when. And how much natural catastrophes you're going to have, and how that will affect in the long run, the reliability and the type of product that we're able to grow, and the type of the issues that you start to see that face you, right? Different quality of
are all the grain handlers moving grain on the waterfront here? All members of your union?
No, the. There is no mission
is not organized.
Yeah, it's not organized. So, but it's all ex-grain handlers for all extensive purposes.
Yeah.
Right? But then the Pool 10 is a small group, so they're not organized either. So, and
so
then
you're representing.
You've got UFCW. Richard. Yeah, and you got UFCW that still represents the group of Canada Malt or.
Oh yeah.
The malt plant, that's UFCW right. Facility.
So you've got Richardson, Viterra, and Cargill.
Yeah, so Superior Grain, yeah.
Superior Grain, those are the three.
Yeah.
Yeah. About 200?
220 members right
220
now.
220 members. Boy. Someone from the prairies would say, oh, how are the mighty fallen? But that's not what the phrase I'd want to put on it here. Very sad in terms of... Well, and one can put it beside you. You mentioned, of course, the Marathon, American Can, to the terrace paper plants and the paper mills. The kinds of... jobs that were available to someone coming out of high school for a long time are pretty well all gone, aren't they? The way in which the workforce in the city has had to change.
Well, I looked out, went to Lakeview High School, which is now, horse have a different name now, right? Yes. Ignatius, and believe in the yeah. You could look out the window and you could see the mill or smell the mill, and so there was one further down Lakeshore Drive, but you're talking about the fine paper, and then you had the shipyards, and then you had the grain elevators, and then you had the wood sawmills.
Yes.
So I mean, where you could see from one side to the other, I mean, any one of those entities that you went and worked at, except Richardson's, is now closed. So. It didn't matter what you picked. It was only a matter of time. And even the shipyards in Tayday, it was 600 people, right? And, I mean, we had about, in the end, we were employing about 80 on a seasonal basis and probably 20 on an annual basis, depending on what type of work you had. It would gear up sometimes even more, a bit more than 80, depending on how much work they had there. Yeah. And the sad part about the shipyards, it was still a viable entity. It was a matter that, the ownership group, was getting a little bit older. And I think part of the family didn't want to take it over, is my understanding. Because when you really look at how it got divested, I mean, it needed some capitalization to extend the dry dock. Yeah. But I mean, that could have still been a feasible operating entity. And it's sad that it got closed down, because if somebody with some foresight and a little bit of assistance. But the boat companies, there's other yards, and the shipping companies, couldn't guarantee somebody, X amount of work. And again, the consolidation of the shipping industry, if you didn't have one of the three main competitors, sort of guaranteeing that they were going to use your facility for
it used to be five-year
specs. For a
long time, wasn't it?
So then the Upper Great Lake, so then you're not going to, you couldn't take the risk that you could open it and then, invest the money. So the sad part about that is that, how do you resurrect, that infrastructure? It's impossible, right? The machinery... The expertise, you talk to somebody like, a friend Tommy Chauvin, if
we have interviewed him. Tommy.
Yes, I mean, it's the stuff he talks about there. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't even believe they could make that kind of stuff there. Right?
Cabinet building, steel work, and so on and so forth. Yeah, it was quite the shop in its day and deserves to be remembered for that. Well, Herb, this has been a quite terrific scan of all sorts of things, and I'm sure most of this is supplementary to what you gave in the narration earlier this year. Any concluding thoughts? You're still in the business yourself for some decades.
Yeah. So I mean, I started in 1975. I was 17 years old, and
well, that's 40 years ago.
Yeah, and it's, so I've
you're not coming a young to man
end,
any longer.
No, I'm coming to the end of my tenure. And there's a new breed, of people in the waterfront now. Although when we did the last ratification vote, we had an issue with temporary workers that was in the table, And I think I rattled a few of their cages because, you know, trying to get them to understand that, you know, if this comes into being, that, you know, they'll replace you with temporary workers. You've got a collective agreement. You need to protect it, and you need to protect it with all your might.
And they saw that?
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, I think somebody suggested I was becoming a little soft. So I think I shook the foundations in that one particular day. But people are, they're new and they're naive. And to be quite frank, they're a little bit experienced in certain aspects of life. And, you know, if you come somewhere in a sort of a silver spoon and you come in, it's like we started in the grain elevators. It was all you could, all the work you wanted, all the overtime you wanted. Yeah. Life was grand. You could buy anything you wanted. But that's, I remember Missouri at a ratification boat years ago, and I mean, I was a recording secretary. Frank Missouri used to have a reel-to-reel, and there's a reel-to-reel tapes of all Frank Missouri stuff. Must be at his house at home. He recorded all his major speeches.
And Mary would have that.
Yeah, right? Mary would have that, I believe. And I remember him saying one
there's
time,
an artifact.
Save your, make sure you save some money because it's not always going to be this way. And I'm thinking, what the hell is this guy talking about? But sure enough, it came into being. And self-fulfilling prophecy or whatever else, they kind of knew it. And I think that the new group that we have hired, because we have an age demographic, so we've had a complete turnover at a couple of the sites for all extensive purposes. And I mean, like, there's six old-school grain handlers left at the one company, and the other 70 have all started in the last 6 or 7 years. Some of them are what I call, you know, they've come back. They left the industry and came back. Right. They have some of that experience. But they're going to have to live what we live through or in the new era, whatever that brings for them, and those types of challenges and whatnot.
And learn the lesson.
Yep, and they'll bring those issues to the table. So we see some issues that we fought for and then relinquished, you know, coming to the forefront again, and they'll end up fighting the fights. And my day is, I'm at the end of my tenure, so, yeah. I mean, I'm going to be passing the torch and not too much longer, and then these are the fights, and there'll be new people that step up to fight and hopefully maintain the integrity of what we've accomplished over the years.
Are your collective agreements gathered anywhere? Are they public documents? Or?
Well, we've got a bunch of copies in the office. I've got the full sets from as far as back as 45, I think.
Would you be up to depositing them somewhere sometime?
Yeah, we got the whole grain archive. It's sort of so we've kept some of the bargaining. We just called them a little bit, but you know, Nancy has gone through some of it. But yeah, we're going to find a home. I was hoping that the grain elevators, you know, that you know, the Friends of Grain Elevators would come up with some type of more permanent setting. It's they could go somewhere where they weren't going to get damaged or
I'll shut that down for a moment.
Okay, I'm going to try to set this up here. Let's see if that works.
Well, we were just talking, I think, about documentation and the possibility. I've been, to the extent that I was asking questions of the archivist, it was certainly in terms of acquisition. And the other place, I suppose, could be the museum. But if the university is going to be serious about an archive, I would think that that would be the place.
Repository of, yeah. I mean, yeah. That's where we want to find it. We want to find a good home that...
Yeah. Guard it carefully for a little while longer, and maybe come, you know, midwinter, maybe things are established.
I've been pretty fortunate overall. Like, just, you know, I often think about this, because you come to the end of your tenure, you sort of think about your, I don't know if you call it your life's work or your life's involvement.
You
I'll
vouch for it.
Yeah. So then, like you said, you know what, you know, you forget, you know, we were cleaning out the offices. We went back, and because we moved to the labor center, of course, there was hundreds of boxes back there. And so I had a president, former president, Tom Hamilton of the Grain, because he was an executive officer in 1976. Oh, really? So he knew they had a property. So I used to talk to him at great length about different things. So he was really informed about labor relations and what we were doing. So we went to cull the documents back there. So it was like, you know, trying to throw out your life's work. I couldn't do it, so I got him to do it. But he went through and we picked all certain stuff. And then you start reading different things you had done. And I wrote this? Like, holy smokes.
That's one of the shocks with this. Documents, right?
Yeah,
so seeing something 30 years earlier you don't remember.
I remember the grain, we were already out on strike for about a week. And I was a nominee for an IAM case pertaining to a lady that was terminated. And so Lewis was the Minister of Transport at the time. I forget who the Minister of Labor was. But in any case, they ordered us to the table. And back to work was legislation was pending. So they got a hold of us, and Wally Dubinsky was the the IM lawyer. But anyhow, he said, well, what are we going to do about this case? You're the nominee, right? And I said, well, we waited already like 7 months to get the case established, so they can freaking well wait. So we basically went ahead, and we did the case that day. We resolved it, you know, well, 2 o'clock, and then I went to the grain negotiation. So the whole country's on standby, waiting for us to get there. But by the time we got there, Lewis, who I think is the transportation minister, had the farmers were having a rally in front of the legislature in Manitoba. So I guess he had to throw them a bone. And the bone was that the grain handlers, he let loose that the grain handlers were going to be ordered back to work. And, of course, then we got that from the local press because that hit the newswire. And then, all hell broke loose. And, of course, the company, nobody was going to bargain after that because there was this pending legislation. And then, but in any case, you know, we had to file there in a nominee, and we were looking at that as we went to discard it, right? So that's a piece of history that I kind of only know about. Yeah. And I says, you know what? I actually put it in another folder,
sure,
just for reference.
And you should write put a memorandum on top of it to explain
But you know, that stuff that's not known. Like that gets, or the back to work. I remember after the strike, they sent me I don't sure what you would call it, but it's a waxed sealed proclamation of the legislation that was passed. That was sent to my house, like my home address. And I didn't have a mailbox, so it was left out, and it was left out because we had a community mailbox. So it was left out, attached, you know, laying against my door. So I opened up this package, and it's the sealed whatever it was proclamation.
It'd be the order in council, or the royal proclamation of the legislation. They probably proclaimed it right after it passed.
So I have that, right?
And
have
that framed.
Yeah, so it's like this kind of stuff. Like what, like, you know, somebody else looked at that. What the heck is this, right? But anyhow, it's not to go on about it, but lived the history and did a lot of, you know, we've had a lot of different experiences, and with this whole downsizing and everything, all the advocacy that we've done, we've tried to do the best we could for the membership, right? Yeah. And to some degree, I like to think that you know, we did the best we could. I mean, there was still a downside. You couldn't stop, you know, the travesty and the hardship. That was just the nature of the beast. That was a business, you know, that's business. But you know, we were on the people side of it, and we tried to, and we did. We did as much as we could to assist people as time went on, and pretty proud of that work, right, in the grain.
But, you know, you should think seriously about writing your memoirs after you retire. Because if it's, say, 45 years, I'm not wanting to guess or prejudge or anything, but even at 40 years now in the industry, you've seen the industry change enormously. And to have a union official's experience, presentation of that memorialization of it would be of invaluable interest to be put in the archive or published for that matter.
Because they have, like, and the thing is that the uniqueness of it is that I had access to all 6 companies.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, and there were 6 different dynamics there, right? No 2 companies were the same at all. Yeah. So then, and of course, you know, I was the most informed person on the Thunder Bay waterfront about grain issues because I was dealing with them on a daily basis, right?
Sure.
And I was hands on. Like, we were down at the site, right? Like, and, you know, it's your worst nightmare, right? The bottom surfacing to the top. Yeah. And the companies, I'm sure. I'm not sure they have a hate, but I mean,
they didn't love you.
No, they didn't love me. And but, you know, I was doing what I thought I had to do. Maybe at first a little more zealous than I needed to be, but I sort of.
What's wrong with zealous?
Yeah, I mellowed out.
Zeal.
Yeah. I mellowed a little bit over time, but. But yeah, you can't lose your value. So I am who I am, and I have my philosophies. And as I say a lot of times at the bargaining now, it's not going to happen on my watch. You have to deal with the next generation on this one because...
You became a steelworkers rep. Did you succeed Mo Shepherd?
Technically, yeah. I mean, Mo, yes. We worked together for a bit, and then I took some of his properties, and then Mo retired, and I simulated the rest of it. So we sort of worked together, right?
So Mo... It's a shame Mo hasn't done memoir.
I mean, he has a lot, you know, he has a lot.
A lot of Timmins and whatnot. Yeah. That's another industry, mining, and so we won't get into that. No. Owen, any questions on your part?
No, just a very interesting interview. And
we could interview you on the spot about the decline in employment in Canada.
Yeah. I used to be on the government side there. I was more responsible for mines going down and paper mills. I stayed on the elevators. I was fortunate that way.
Well, was the youth employment service the thin edge of the wedge for the decline? Privatization of employment services?
Well, it didn't start off that way, but it certainly did.
I mean, in a sense, it. And I was involved with, at St. Paul's United as chair of the board in opening the youth center for the first operation, summer of 81, a youth employment service. And I felt a little bit rueful about it. It was a good service. It was a needed service. I'm sure it has, for, to the present day, served the youth well.
I think what,
but
I think
it's
what,
not part of the government.
I think what happened in the evolution of what's happening in the government sector is it's more or less just, it's straight up, it's like the, you know, we used to have four, like, Labour Canada, you know, representatives here, right? We have none.
Yeah.
There are few far between. Like, we get serviced out of Sudbury.
Yeah.
And if, and I think maybe there's one rep, he works out of a virtual office. But I think that it's a matter of, the EI section of the public service is going to be this big, and you'll provide whatever services you can. And then you go to Service Canada now. I mean, no disrespect to the presenter, very nice fellow. I knew as much. Thunder Bay, I knew more than through my experiences and what I had read, I knew more than he did about the EI program. So he comes to a meeting of laid off shipyard workers that have just got all this money clawed back from the severance payment that we got. No, so he was, and he did his best. If I can't answer the question, I'll leave it with me and I'll try to find the answer for you. I'm not going to tell you something I don't know. He was very good. Like, he did all the right things.
Honest.
But it was different than before. We had like a special that was to come there, and they knew what was happening. You could ask them questions and they knew how the system operated. And and again, this is when people that we could approach on a commonsensical basis, right?
Yeah.
And before the umpire system got, turfed, I mean, we were at Terrace Bay. I mean, we must have had like 10 or a dozen cases.
Mm-hmm.
And all this misinformation. So the umpire, give the one fellow there, he runs the different where they have the parks and that. What the heck's his name? Hartley, is it? Or,
oh, Bob Hartley?
Yeah. So I think he was a chairman of the
conservation.
Bill Hartley, yeah. I mean, so he would, if there was some question I was asking, and so you've asked us five times, he put the tape down and we'd call downstairs and get somebody upstairs. What's Mr. Danaher talking about? Like, there was that type of an accountability. I don't even know. I haven't dealt with the new AI system. I mean, it all seems to be electronic. It's paper filing.
Well, it was just somebody's idea that a lot of the work could be centralized, which gutted, the local operations.
The cuts that began under Martin, perhaps, in the 90s?
That would have started with Martin.
Yeah.
And Kretchen, the big layoffs.
Yeah, 95 and later.
Yeah.
In fact, was Lewis the transport minister? Was that early 90s, the Christian government?
Yeah.
I mean, he has a lot to answer for.
Yeah, it was definitely
under Kretchen and Martin.
But as I was in the employment end of things for the most part, and it was just less expensive to farm it out to not-for-profit organizations.
Yeah, sure. Oh,
yeah. You didn't have to worry.
So I understand the rationale.
Much less.
But, damn people's futures, pensions, livelihoods in between, and so on and so forth. Just damn all of that.
I think the service was better for many of the same reasons that Herb was referring to there, because you had a group of people who actually had been there a while and knew the system.
Yeah, inevitably.
Most of your people you've worked with were my colleagues, probably Wendy Weir and Hugh Hennessy. He was in Labour Canada way back. Good people. So, and you just don't, and that's 30 years of experience. You just don't replace that.
No.
And I probably know the poor chap that was, like the raw meat in the shark case there.
Yeah.
So, and he would, that's too bad.
We had this, just digress a bit, but we had a system where you could get banked overtime. So what you would do is you'd get your banked overtime and you would pay, I can't remember, we were over the threshold, so likely on your overtime you didn't end up paying an EI contribution. But so if you took the banked overtime, you either had to declare, you could take it as like a cash payout,
mm-hmm.
like you took it out of your bank account, or you could take it in a manner that was deducted from your EI. And I'm not sure if these, and if you did that, if you got it deducted from your EI, then those hours would count as hours worked towards your claim. So you had to be very careful about how you went about this, right? Because a lot of people just viewed it as a deferred account, an emergency fund. So then we had to get a ruling. The EI couldn't quite figure this out. So after, it's going back with the liaison and then getting the ruling from down east, about this. But lo and behold, I went on for 10 years, so I had all of the documentation, all the rulings we had in an information package, and then it kind of quieted it down. It wasn't an issue for a while, then it resurrected itself. And they're revisiting the same story, you know, and trying to get you know, somebody new to understand what had happened here. But again, when you change the hours from weeks to, or change the system from weeks to hours, like those 80 hours could mean the difference about getting on a claim or not getting on a claim. And you had to make your play now. Like, you had to make your play when you took it, because it had to be taken by the end of March. So either you had to make a decision today, not knowing how much you might work in the following year, right?
Yeah. The other thing that you probably would remember at the beginning of your career is we also did all the elevator recalls for the elevators here in town. And Eric Erickson, I don't know if you ever ran into Eric.
I don't recall the name.
He's probably working with Frank Mazur, but he'd have 2,000 recalls. And it was almost as if, you know, the green elevators, the union and the government were all working as one big entity to get the, you know, to keep.
Well, I remember going to the EI office and I wanted to get work. Like, I was always looking for work, right? And it was hard. Like, people wouldn't hire grain handlers because they knew you were going to leave. But I remember going there and he says, "You're working a grain business?" He says, "We don't have anything for you. Like, just keep sending your cards in and go away. Like, and you're going to get called back in the spring. Don't worry about it."
There, of course, is what UI should be for in part. When you have a skilled workforce that is necessary, part of the year. Keep them in storage, on the shelf, whatever phrase you want to use, but have the UI. And that was, I think, the original leading intent. Well, we could go on forever, I suspect. I want to brag about all the NDP MPs who represented port cities and so on and so forth. You know, two of us here at Thunder Bay, Rod Murphy there, Jim Fulton up there, and two or three in Vancouver. Not that we could change very much. Anyway, it's been a great pleasure to chat with you here into more than kibitz. This has been a very interesting survey of things, Herb. Thanks so